This morning, it is Wednesday, August the 6th, 1997, and I am interviewing Bill Camfield. Bill, I don't know exactly what year you came to Houston, but would you talk to me about when you came and what was going on in Houston as you remember it in the arts, in the public sector as well as the private sector with the galleries, maybe starting more or less with the public sector?
Jenny and I came to Houston to work at the University of St. Thomas over the winter of 1963-64. I began teaching at St. Thomas in that spring semester of 1964. I came here expressly because I've grown up in Texas, a native Texan, and had decided that I'd like to come back for a few years. And while working as a graduate student at Yale, Jerry McKagey had come through, and the director of graduate studies there knew that I was interested in maybe going back to Texas, and so I said, why don't you meet this woman? And we met literally under a vitrine, a table, in the Yale Art Gallery. Jerry was down on her hands and knees when our founder trying to see how they constructed this vitrine. She really liked it. So we literally met on our hands and knees on the floor. And I said, hey, this is somebody a little different. And so it turned out that the most interesting job in Texas at that time, bar none, SMU, Texas, Rice, etc., was at the University of St. Thomas. So we met the Dumanils and others, and Jenny and I decided to come here. And we came in the spring semester of 64. And as you know, Jerry, who was diabetic, had a seizure and died 6 weeks after we got here. So we sort of introduced to Houston by fire in a way, but Dominique and I, just in shock, picked up the the department. I took over Jerry's teaching chores, and Dominique took over the exhibitions that were there, and we sort of came up for air in the summer. I don't know that I learned much about Houston that spring of 64 because we were just working overtime. I was still finishing my PhD at Yale. that spring was a hellish year. But I began to see more of what was going on in Houston, I think, beginning in that summer. And I found Houston enjoyable, but did not have a whole lot to offer at that time in the 60s. That there were only a handful of galleries, only a handful of artists, handful of other cultural activities going on, and that Jenny and I found that we could, in the first few years in Houston, that we could go to all of the private gallery openings, all of the museum openings, go to the symphony, go out and visit artist studios,
still have time,
drink beer with Dick Ray, and still have time. And that changed dramatically as times went on, particularly in the 70s. But in the 60s, in terms of private art galleries, you had Meredith Long Houston Galleries, and you had the Louisiana Gallery, and you had Butte Gallery. And then later in the 60s, some others came along. The Kiko Gallery, for example, was very active on the scene for a few years in the late 60s. Catherine Swenson had a gallery that was very interesting, but it was really closing down when we got here. She had only a couple of openings, two or three openings that I can recall.
What was she showing?
She was showing international surrealist art. Very impressive artwork. Very impressive. One wondered how it came to be in Houston. She, I think, had contacts with Jerry McKagey, and perhaps it had something
connection
to do with Manil McKagey connection, right? And they were very impressive shows, but as I say, just two or three of those that I recall.
Where was her gallery?
It was in a private home, wonderful two-story, early 20th century frame home in the Montrose area, off on Taft or Garrett or one of those streets in there, the near town area. Wonderful house. But the galleries who were established were three: Louisiana Gallery, Houston Gallery, and Butte. And again, just a handful of artists that really seem to be representing sort of the avant-garde scene in Houston.
Who is Kiko showing?
Kiko showed also, for the most part, international 20th century artists. You could go there to see some Calder prints, Picasso drawings, Little Max Ernst, a variety of established 20th century people. In addition to that, I'm sure there were still other shows, other artists, including some regional artists, but for the most part, it was international modern art.
What about David Gallery?
David Gallery also, thanks, that's another one. Like Kiko, opened up later in the 60s and was a very lively gallery. That probably went on into the early 70s.
Who owned that gallery?
Diane David.
Diane.
And it was on San Felipe, near Meredith's gallery. Big old house with an addition in the back. She dealt primarily with local and regional art.
Okay.
So that she would be showing people like Earl Staley and Camblin and lots of others. I'm sure that I've forgotten some of the shows she had there, but always had stimulating openings, big crowd, heavy drinking crowd. She had a tattoo show there once, actually had live, late 60s live tattoo artist, and you could get a tattoo there if you were up to it. So it had color, had vitality and color, and it dealt more with with local and regional artists, insofar as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that contributed some flavor to it, but still a fairly small scene, a small art world. Everybody knew everybody.
Now, let's see, in 64, CAA was moving on, but I don't believe it had become CAM yet. Had it? Or was it right in that time period it was happening?
I don't remember when that happened.
Well, go back to St. Thomas and how that evolved, that whole situation over there. You continued teaching?
I continued teaching, right, and Dominique and I knew that we needed help after that spring where we picked up the program. And so we began to search for new people. That fall of that year of 64, I think we announced a job opening or two. And that led to the hiring, in terms of art history, of Mino Badner, who was the first person we hired, and then Walter Widrig and Philip Oliver Smith. So we ended up with four art historians there in a year or two. Probably took us a couple of years to do that. And also, it led to the hiring of Jeff Winningham in photography and James Blue in filmmaking. And there were other people involved too, but basically, these were the people hired in the arts. So St. Thomas became really the liveliest center. And in the 60s, Peter Gunther opened a department at the University of Houston. It was very small, and not a whole lot going on there. And John O'Neill opened the art department here at Rice in 65. Prior to that, the art department at Rice had not been a department. It had been a section within the School of Architecture. But in 1965, John O'Neill was hired from Oklahoma University to turn it into a separate department. And Catherine Brown taught, and they hired another art historian. So usually two and a half art historians here and several painters. John O'Neill brought in Earl Staley, for example, Bob Camblin, who continued to contribute to the scene. But the most active scene was at St. Thomas. So we had, particularly in the exhibition program and in art history, we didn't have that much going on in terms of studio art, excepting, of course, Winningham and Blue, who were major contributors to the city then and still, the legacy's still there.
Did you say UH came on around 64, 65?
I don't remember exactly when Peter began to teach there, but somewhere in the early mid-60s. He was here when I arrived, but I don't think he'd been here very long.
Okay.
And I don't know if it was really a department. It was art department, and he was art historian to there. But but University of Houston did not seem to have much of a profile in the city when we arrived. In a way, Peter was his graduate student and at the University of Texas, and they didn't offer a PhD, I don't think, until the early 70s. I was on the review committee for the establishment of a PhD program at the University of Texas, I think in 1972. So,
do we have a PhD program in Houston?
No.
I don't think so.
Still don't have one.
Why not?
Many reasons. We've never had the critical mass to do one. Rice has been talking about one off and on for several years, and we may have one here one of these days, but there's never been the support for that or the call for that at any of the universities. And it's more complicated than that. You know, it's conceivable that we will develop the critical mass at Rice. We're not far away from that. We seem to be getting strong support from the dean now. Mm-hmm. And we could go that way. But even if there was a support beyond that, it's a serious question of, does the world need another PhD program in the history of art? Like most of the other fields in academia, there are far more candidates for jobs than there are jobs. And so you raise questions, can you attract good students? And if you do, can you get them decent jobs once they graduate? So that's going to be a difficult question for us. But we do have a good little graduate program, and we're looking to grow that and make it better still. But whether or not it goes into a PhD will be several years down the road. I probably won't be around for that decision.
Going back to St. Thomas, when you arrived, the art program at St. Thomas was how many years old? Just a couple of years old?
When
had McKagey and Mrs.
Dumanil
started?
McKagey and the Dumanils had started the program at St. Thomas about 1958-59 when McKagey left CAM or was not renewed at CAM.
What was the background on that,
There are others who can tell you a lot more about that because I have sort of a slender bookish knowledge, but basically it was a division of opinion about the nature of the museum or the association. One party felt that it was to be a very democratic or sort of organization that would be staffed by volunteers with various people in the city who had backgrounds, experience in the arts, organizing various single exhibitions, and then someone else would take on this, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And then another group was convinced that if CA was going to continue and thrive and to amount to anything, that it had reached a stage where it needed professional direction. It needed a professional museum person to direct it and a professional staff for installations and publications and everything else. And the Manils were strong voices in that ladder. And they also had the money and the commitment to, back up their position. And I think some people felt like the Manils were beginning to be too strong in that. But they were hardly the only one. I mean, there were a lot of people who felt that the professional route was the only route to take.
Well, prior to that time, then, it sounds like prior to the Manils going over to St. Thomas, you didn't have any academic program in Houston, Texas. Is that correct?
No, that's not exactly correct. Rice University had for years James Chilman, who, as you know, was director of the Museum of Fine Arts and a part-time teacher at Rice. He'd been here since 1916. He taught history of architecture and other history courses. And from time to time, Rice had someone else doing a little academic work in history of art and architecture. But I don't know if there was anyone else in the city.
But there wasn't an art department.
There was not an art department until 1965. Catherine Brown was hired in 1963 at Rice to do some art history courses, and she knew so much more about art history and history of architecture and so forth that the School of Architecture said, hey, keep her. And that happened. So there was basically, though, what existed in terms of academic offerings in the University of in Houston. Insofar as I know, it was very slender, and it came through James Chilman at Rice and a few other people sort of came and went.
So really, when the Manils went to St. Thomas, it was to solidify and nurture a direction that was going to be more professional, was going to be more focused, and it was going to enter into the academic arena, but also probably be mounting exhibitions and producing publications, etc. Is that kind of coming out of the camp, you think?
You'll need to talk to other people about that, including Mrs. Dumanil. I'm not sure exactly what all they wanted to do, but I think that the Manils were committed to the city, and because they had come to a splitting point with the CAA, that they wanted to continue that commitment with the city in some way, and the University of St. Thomas offered a possibility for that, and Jerry McCaggie. They wanted to keep Jerry McCaggie. She had brought so much to the city and to them as individuals, I think. And again, St. Thomas, I think, was a place where that can happen. I don't know what all they meant to do. I know that they wanted to continue to have stimulating exhibitions. I know that they wanted to continue to foster a knowledge of and a love of the arts in the city. Whether or not they intended to have an academic program or not, I don't know, but Jerry McCaggie was teaching courses in the history of art as well as organizing these stimulating exhibitions, and she decided, I can't do it all. I need real art historian here so I can spend more time doing exhibits, and that's how we got together. And after Jerry's death, both Dominique Dumanil and I said, we need help. Both of us need help. I said, I can't continue to do this. I was teaching everything. And so Dominique went for some help, and I went for some help.
Well, how did
that That sort of grew, though. I don't know that it was...
How did the department grow? I mean, you were just starting out in 64. Mm-hmm. So how did the department... what direction did it take? Did it take more of a practical, or was the practical side as well as the art history side fairly balanced as it came along?
No, there was very little studio arts.
Very little.
Except for film and photography. But that developed early. I can't actually, Sally, remember the dates on that. But I think The first art historian we hired was Mino Badner out of Columbia University, and his specialty was tribal arts, primitive arts, African, oceanic, etc. He was superb, wonderful person.
What happened to him?
He died of a heart attack about 1975. He went with the Dumanil shift to Rice in 1969, but here it is. Deceased in 75. Then Winningham and Blue came on board early. John Dumanil was keenly interested in film photography, particularly film.
What happened to Blue?
Blue also died in the mid-70s of cancer. It was just a stunning...
What was his first name again?
James.
James.
Superb filmmaker and teacher. And Jeff Winningham, of course, is still here. Mm-hmm. And has really been sort of a pioneer for opening art photography and study photography in this city.
Well, now, what year did you come and Mrs. Dumanil come to Rice?
That occurred in the fall of 1969. 69-70 was the first year of the Dumanil group here.
Did you come over at the same time?
Yes. I had never planned to stay long in Texas, and actually I'd almost signed a contract at Brown University, and I bid the Domineels goodbye, and we were about to move to Rhode Island, but unbeknownst to us, there were already difficulties between the Domineels and the University of St. Thomas, and that developed in the year that we were negotiating with Brown. And the Domineels, without pressuring us, just asked us that we would stay to help the transition, and Rice did too, and we did, and we're still here. The Manils left a small collection of books and other things, but St. Thomas developed a stronger art department in terms of studio art. Earl Staley, he was hired as the chair at the University of St. Thomas, and built a very lively little department there with Bob Camblin and Jack Boynton. And also there was one historian, and I'm sorry, her name is escaping me now, good friend, who was a classicist who dealt with classical Greek and Roman art. And I believe she's still there.
Well, can you think of anything else in your memory about the time, I guess it was about 5 years at St. Thomas?
Yes, it was a really lively place in terms of not only what I mentioned before in terms of the growing program in art history and particularly film and photography, but visiting artists, thanks to the Domineels. There were major artists coming in from time to time, Marcel Duchamp, René Magritte, Enrique Mata, Jean-Luc Godard, and you never knew who was coming by. Okay.
Great.
In terms of scholars, Dominique John asked me to basically look after that, and then later Mino and Walter and Philip when they were there. But we had just stunning exhibition series with such scholars as Rudolf Witkober and George Hurd Hamilton and Rosenblum and Ellen Johnson and Dietrich von Bottmer and Posner and on and on and on, and just a sterling series of lectures. And Dominique proved herself to be more than an able student of Jerry McCaggie when it came to conceiving and installing exhibitions, very stimulating exhibitions.
In Houston in 75, the first exhibit that I saw was a Greek exhibit. Yeah. Over the museum, but it was fabulous.
Yes. Well, that's one that caught my attention too. Oh. The Dominique inherited a Magritte exhibition from Jerry McCaggie that spring that she died, and it was to be installed in the little Arkansas Art Center in Little Rock. And Jenny and I stopped in Little Rock to see it on the way up to Yale to get my PhD degree. And it was just magical, absolutely magical. Left that exhibition that Dominique had picked up and installed from scratch with very little time to prepare. And the whole state of Arkansas began to look like the Greek paintings. Arkansas has never looked better. So they also had a print club there, which was very important for the Manils as part of their
St. Thomas.
Part of their commitment to the city, again, to foster knowledge of the arts and a love of the arts. People want to live with the arts, and a print club was a way for people who didn't know much about the arts or who were timid and didn't want to, either couldn't or didn't want to invest a lot of money until they got further into it, to actually own something. And they're very exciting programs once or twice a year, where actually my wife Jenny was director of the print club there for a while, and she would they would pay for her transportation to go to New York or Paris. I was going back and forth research on Paris, and so Jenny would go along with me and hit all of the major print dealers in Paris and come back with these wonderful prints, major 20th century and 19th century figures. Fabulous. And then there would be a big sale of these, and everybody came out. It was a big social event, and people could acquire a Rouault print or a Picasso etching or what you name it, you know, a contemporary piece by some European or whoever, and a big event. And it started a number of people on collecting. And in addition to the print club, where you could buy something for $10 to $1,000, they had a club, collector's club, for people with deeper pockets that met at their house. And they would
What was that called?
Can't remember what they called that. They'd actually bring in on consignment major paintings and sculptures, or I would call major paintings and sculptures,
yeah.
And people would sort of choose maybe, you know, a dozen for dinner, and they would choose this painting or that sculpture, and they'd live with it for a couple of months, and then they would rotate them around, and if somebody fell in love with something, they had a chance to buy it. If not,
they bid on it, didn't they?
I'm not sure how they did that. You'll need to get details on that.
Well, Clark's father was in that, and Henry Thompson was in that. Mm-hmm. I know Mr. Farfel.
Yes.
Was part of that, and Lois was talking about that one day.
Mm-hmm.
They would live with it in their homes.
Yes.
And then they would, somebody would, then, and if two people wanted it, they'd kind of bid for it.
Mm-hmm.
How did that work, Bill? Did they put in a certain amount of money and then they decide on a few pieces that they wanted to buy? Do you remember?
I think it worked something like that. I think that usually something was bought, but you'll have to ask someone else about the details. Yeah, it's still turning.
Okay, well, that's
I was not part of that group.
That's exciting, though, with those kinds of things.
Yes. And that's carried on to Rice. The print club was continued at Rice when the Domenel shifted here. And there are other options now in the city through the Houston Center for Photography has their wonderful auction and other things going on. It's a very effective way of getting people involved.
When the Manels came, you came to Rice, Was it a Quonset hut, or what was it that actually became the museum? It was more or less a temporary building, wasn't it?
They were meant to be temporary buildings, yes, but they're still there. And one of the arguments from trusty old guy at Rice is, God damn, I remember University of Texas where they brought in these Quonset huts after World War II, and they're supposed to be temporary, and they're still there, and I won't stand for this. But they're not Quonset huts, but as you know, they're corrugated metal, so they're squared off Quonset huts. But they are very elegant inside, and they're not only still here, but they are highly sought after spaces. I mean, there are people in this campus who would kill to have one of those buildings now.
What were they used for before they became part of this art?
Well, they were put up by the Domenels. See, the Domenels and San Thomas split ways in the spring of and summer of 64 or 69, and Rice was interested in picking up not only the people in the arts at San Thomas. There were a handful of other people, a very interesting young man in economics, a Dominican priest in theology and French literature, etc. There's a whole troop of us came over. Rice had to find places for us. The Domenels proposed a building that would fit in with the campus in terms of the type of brickwork and historical reference and design, etc. But there wasn't time for that, or people didn't think there was time for that, and where to put it, so forth. So for the Muir, the decision was made to put those two buildings out there, the buildings that now house the Media Center and the Continuing Studies Program. And one building was and continued to be the Media Center. The other building that now houses Continuing Education was the barn, so to speak, which was the exhibition hall. And it was the Institute for the Arts at Rice. It was the entity. Actually, and one of the people who came over at that time, too, I've forgotten to mention, who had been hired a year or two before, was Thomas McEvely,
mm-hmm.
who was teaching, actually, classics at the University of St. Thomas. He's trained in classics. But we were all together there, and Tom was interested in mythology, which led him into imagery. symbolism, and Tom was already beginning to make a change from classics to something approaching the history of art, mixture of history of art, criticism, philosophy, etc. But because he no longer seemed to fit anywhere, he became a sort of attached to the Institute of the Arts at Rice out there. And Tom has continued to teach part-time at Rice ever since.
I audited a class with his that my daughter was taking. Yeah. Years ago. She's still flying into town a couple of days a week.
In the spring.
Doing it that way?
Yeah.
It hadn't stopped.
Still running.
Okay. Well, is there anything else before we move into Rice? Now, let's see. We're at the end of the 60s. You kind of hit on the galleries. And is there anything else about the St. Thomas that you can think of before kind of shifting totally into Rice?
No, I don't think so.
It's a very vital time.
Very vital time.
Okay, we're now on the second side of the tape and visiting with Bill Camfield. Okay, Bill, let's go back to... Probably we should move into the early 70s and 70s at Rice and also in Houston. Anything that was kind of going back and forth and bridging some things there.
I'm pausing a minute to think and look at some notes here. The 70s became richer early on, right away. Certainly at Rice, where things changed radically in terms of the arts at Rice, was a domino shift, because finally there was really an art department, in the sense there were five art historians and there were five artists. It became immediately a sort of a balanced department. Previously, Rice had more people in studio arts and not much in art history, or relatively little, and vice versa at St. Thomas, and it became a more integrated and balanced department. And it's remained that way. And it, under the leadership of John O'Neill, continued to be the chair for a while, and then I was acting chair for a little while. But it became a complex department, too, which nobody really recognized, because in addition to the department per se, the media center being physically separate tended to become an entity of its own. Both Winningham and Blue were empire builders out there. So the media center was part of the art department, but practically it was out there, and they had lots of money and lots of ambition, lots of energy, lots of talent, and
that blowing and going.
Yeah. And then, unbeknownst to most people, drama was part of the department.
Who? Yeah,
drama. The drama program is part of the art department. It's been for
years. Okay.
And then John O'Neill had opened a little gallery just by pushing aside some desk in the secretarial area of the department. And when we came to Rice, Sewell Hall was coming up out of the ground. And a gallery was provided in that building. So suddenly, beginning in 1970-71, the art department had a very lively media center, the continuing drama program at Rice. It had a gallery. It had art and art history in balance, and a lot was going on. And the print and the Institute for the Arts, which was a separate entity
from the art department.
From the art department, the Institute. Mrs. Dumanil was the director of the Institute for the Arts, and she really transplanted the whole St. Thomas program: exhibitions, visiting artists, visiting scholars, print club. All of that was going on out in the barn, which we called it. And then the art department was making its own way.
How was the Institute of the Arts, how did it interface with the university, in the sense that was it headquartered at Rice, or was it operating out of Rice?
Yes, it became official part of the Rice University, and you would have to talk with some of the people at Rice, and maybe at the Manil collection now.
I'll be getting into there.
Okay. I was privy to some of the arrangements for coming over here, but I don't know how that was set up in a legal and administrative way. But it became part of Rice. But Mr. Dumanil was essentially given leeway to continue the sort of program she'd had at St. Thomas. In terms of the interface with Rice, they tried, but I don't think many of the people at Rice ever really understood that much about it. The Manils came, unfortunately, with a reputation in the eyes of some people here at Rice that they had been too big a presence, too pushy a presence at University of St. Thomas, and prior to that at the CAA, Contemporary Arts Association. And there are some people here at this university who really thought that the Manils were going to take over Rice University. They were going to change dramatically the nature of this university. They were afraid of the Manils. I mean, it's absolutely preposterous, then and in hindsight.
Right.
On the other hand, there are people here at Rice who are very supportive. But I'm afraid there was not the sort of informed and warm welcome that one would have wanted for the Manils here. In hindsight, too, I can understand that here, because here people leaving the university in the spring of 1969, in the fall of 1969, here's a whole new entity, nobody asked me about it, that is a problem. It's a personal sort of problem we all understand on that level. And the university had never seen anything like that. And some people were absolutely enthralled and very supportive, and others were not keen on it. In fact, there are others here, old mossy horn people at Rice that go back for decades, who thought that they really wanted an institute. They didn't like any of the arts at Rice. They begrudged what existed at Rice before in the arts, and they were damned if they were going to sit by silently while the arts expanded at Rice. I mean, we've had to overcome some of that background at the university.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the students flocked to it. I mean, the students
I'm
were very
sure.
excited. Yeah, they were very excited. So,
the early 70s then, on the Rice campus, with the Institute and the ongoing nurturing and development of the program, was really moving.
Really very exciting.
Very strong.
Yeah. One regret I have is that we looked right away for a new chair to preside over and lead all of this. John O'Neill didn't want to continue as chair, and I didn't want to have the chairmanship of it. So both of us took a whack at it, but we tried to recruit someone new, vital, come in and be a leader and administrator over all of this. And we weren't successful in finding anyone who really caught our imagination. And so early on, it became a decision to sort of rotate the chairmanship, try to have some sort of even balance between historians and studio people chairing it. And it's only been as of last year that, thanks to a new dean, that we've been authorized to go again for a really distinguished person, an art historian, who will be charged to come in and lead the whole department. So I think we've gone through a generation. We're at a turning point where hopefully we're going to find some brilliant, stimulating person to come in and lead this portion of the arts at Rice to what it's going to be in the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
So. And Houston, yeah. You want me to go back to the 70s and pick up? I just talked about Rice in the 70s. Or you want me to go on to the 80s?
No, go ahead. Keep going.
70s and other things, if we moved to another university, U of H, their program began to develop. But particularly in studio arts, George Bunker came in as chair, I think, in 1974. And about that time, some new faculty members were coming in, people like Gail Stack. And beginning in the mid-70s, with the leadership of George Bunker and some new people, as well as some old folks there, University of Houston really developed a significant program in studio arts. They had tended to have not much still in art history. The art history program over there has always been dominated by the studio department. But you know that U of H was a place to be in the mid and late 70s. and a lot of activities going on. And that included Bill Robinson, who was hired as the director of the Blafford Gallery. Mm-hmm. And Bill had a very lively program over there, and he revived the Houston area exhibitions, which I think helped generate some local pride. And at the University of St. Thomas, Earl Staley, who had been here at Rice and then let go by John O'Neill, as I've already indicated, opened a small but thriving department, University of St. Thomas, and they too provided a charge to the city. And he was charged up. And it was a boom year. It was a boom decade. I mean, people were making money. And to go back to the University of St. Thomas, the Manils had already introduced Philip Johnson to this city as an architect. But in 1974, Penzoil got to him, and he did that Twin Towers, which, you know, sort
that
of...
That was how I got into the art business, through the
pause. Yeah. Well, you know, that was a breakthrough. You know, no one had ever seen a skyscraper like this. What is going on? It was a symbol of the dynamism of the city and the boom years of the city. And the Museum of Fine Arts took off... They hired De Montebello actually in 69, and De Montebello, though he was perceived as elitist and northeastern and not compatible with Houston in the south, he really made a commitment to that museum and to the city. Very important.
He was here, did he come in 69?
69.
And then he must have left around 75.
74. 74, I think.
He wasn't here when I came to Houston. Yeah. He just left.
Sweeney was a one-man operation.
Yeah.
He couldn't have other important people around, curators doing this or that. He was doing it all. But the Montebello brought in a professional crew of curators. Jack Schrader, medievalist, E.A. Carmine, modernist, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy Lee. David Warren, I think David was already there.
David, I think, has been on since, I think, the late 60s.
Late
I'm going
60s.
To track all that because I was going through the archives.
Yeah, thanks. But, you know, suddenly the Museum of Fine Arts had a real cadre of professional curators. And they began to do more diverse shows, and the purchases began to expand, partly because of the boom city.
Right.
The wonderful families like the Browns and the Cullens and Cullinans could do more for the museum. The collection began to grow. And after De Montebello, A.G. came in, and he brought lots of new growth too. The Brown Endowment Funds came in under A.G. Target store and the carpet world began to get into it. Target stores began to make money available to buy Texas and regional arts and photography. So that with AG, there was a growth in some major modern works acquired. There was the development of the photography department. He brought in Ann Tucker,
mm-hmm.
just a major move for the city, and began to deal with some local and regional art. And with the backing of those wonderful patrons and families in the museum, A.G. was able to do some extraordinary purchases,
mm-hmm.
not just modern either. I mean, he was he got that fantastic Gothic head, Tyrol head. He got the Assyrian relief, and it just all across the board. So there's a lot going on at the Museum of Fine Arts in the 70s as well. What else? And in the city, again, just a boom city. CAM came on in the 70s. You know, CAM was...
Cathcart was here in the 70s. And
yeah.
Also, I'll go back and...
Herathus. You know, yeah. CAM picked up in the late 60s with Lefty Adler. But then Lefty had flaws. I think he alienated a lot of people. And in 1971, when they opened the new building, he opened it with this show that just horrified so many people. Probably the best thing by far that Lefty had ever done. I have reservations about the quality of much of what he had done in terms of exhibitions, but that one was serious. It was good. And
that's the what, the chickens?
One with the chickens and cockroaches and rats, etc.
I've been told about that.
And unfortunately that did him in, but people couldn't get over that. So again, for a few years, there's another about a 2-year gap where
yeah.
Cam was floundering, but not much money, not much support. Are we going to come out of this? But Harris was hired, and he gave a shot too. And again, a little bit like the University of Houston, he dealt so much with local and regional artists
mm-hmm.
that it did a lot to build a sense of Houston's got something going. And they began to talk about a third coast. It's
yeah,
not just East Coast, West Coast, but the Gulf Coast. This is a place to be. We've got something here unique and vital and original. And some of the established artists began to get more national attention. And there were some exchange shows that got Houston artists out into
mm-hmm.
Philadelphia, Detroit, L.A., New York, etc.
Even Sweden.
The people began to think by the late 70s, that this was something was going to happen here. Why not Houston? Of course, it coincided with a decade in the whole country in the arts where New York was challenged. We had moved out of those heydays of the 60s where somewhere we knew where the avant-garde was. We could define them. It was op art, pop art, minimal art, conceptual art, whatever. These seemingly more or less coherent groups, just one after another, so much energy. In the 70s, suddenly, there's no new ism. You know, where are we? It seemed to be no direction, and New York was faltering, and Europe was staging a comeback, and it was up for grabs. Maybe
and Houston had a lot of vitality.
And
a lot
Houston
of money.
Had it, you know, and it's no longer New York. It's going to happen somewhere else, and why not here? And so a lot of that was going on.
Let's stop right now with it's August the 7th, 1997, and I'm continuing my conversation with Bill Camfield. We're going to continue on tape two with Bill Camfield and briefly review the progression for the Institute of the Arts at Rice.
Sally, regarding the Institute of the Arts, this, as you know, the negotiations began in 1969, and the Institute was set up towards the end of the 1969, and the Dumanils came over with a handful of art historians and a few other people in other disciplines. The Institute for the Arts was a distinct entity at Rice, and it came as a 5-year commitment. As you may know, the Dumanils, Mr. and Mrs. Dumanil, John and Dominique, like to be catalyst for activities in the city and did not like to endow projects. They wanted to do something which they thought was exciting and helpful for an institution or the city, and if it proved to be exciting and desirable for that institution or that entity, to then pick it up, and they would move on to do something else. Rice, on the other hand, is an institution that was pretty adamant in having operations endowed from the beginning. They want to have the endowment. They don't want to be surprised later on by having to find funds to take care of an operation that is not endowed. So at the initial negotiations between the Dumanils and Rice regarding Institute for the Arts, there was something of a bind, working as a catalyst rather than endowing something. It went the Dumanil way in the sense that the Institute for the Arts was not an endowed entity at Rice, distinct entity, but not an endowed entity. It came as a 5-year project with the notion that if Rice liked what was going on, that Rice would gradually phase in and the Dumanils would phase out. During the course of that first 5-year commitment, the Institute, Rice did not phase in. The Dumanils continued their support at the same high level throughout. The Dumanils made a second, as I understand it, made a second 5-year commitment, but presumably made it clear that this was not to be an ongoing 5-year renewal, that the university had to step up that period if they meant to. You need to talk to other people about this, because although I was privy to some of the initial negotiations, I do not have any firsthand, you know, sitting at the table knowledge of later negotiations. But indeed, during that second five-year period, Rice did make efforts to find some means to raise the money to continue that operation, or most of the operation that had been brought in by the Dumanils. And the major player in this was the Brown Foundation. I should pause to say that the university did not take up everything, or try to take up everything. From the beginning, there was a commitment to the art historians and to the media center, but not to the exhibition program of the Dumanils. That is to say, the university did not feel like it could pick up what the Dumanils were doing in terms of the exhibitions out there. That was just, right. That was too costly. And in a way, so identified with Mrs. Dumanil that there was no way to do it without her. She was the only one who could do it. Rice University couldn't take over that. So the more conventional teaching instruction was taken over. Something that may have been a little bit confusing too to people, and maybe I confused it yesterday, was that although I came with the Dumanils, I and the other historians and teachers were immediately made members of the regular departments at Rice University. Mm-hmm. The Dumanils may have been putting in the money that paid for my salary. I don't know about that. But I was immediately a member of the Department of Art and Art History, mm-hmm. not a member of the Institute of the Arts at Rice. Okay. There were a couple of exceptions. I think I mentioned yesterday that Tom McEvely was sort of unidentifiable in standard university tracks. He'd begun as a classicist, but he had become a historian, critic, author, etc. So he did not go into the classics department nor the art department, but he remained a member of the Institute of the Arts. But for the most part, the others of us became professors in departments. Okay. And were continued when the Brown Foundation helped Rice pick up that commitment in the second five-year period. The Institute, that took us up to about 1980-81. The Institute for Arts was still here at Rice. It was still functioning, still had exhibitions and lectures and all sorts of activities. But it was beginning to wind down somewhat, and Rice would step in a little bit more. And I don't know when the Institute for the Arts ceased to be.
Well, but, physically, when the museum was built and the actual works and a place, you know, to exhibit came about, then didn't they vacate that?
Yes. The Dumanils vacated the barn somewhere, I assume, around 1987 when the Milt Dumanil collection, the Renzo Piano Building, opened up.
Well, that would have extended the Institute then almost another 5 years.
Almost another 5 years.
So it was almost 15 years.
Almost 15 years, but the third 5 years with declining activities.
Yeah.
And as before, the Dumanils even then did not leave completely. During that third five-year period, if we call it that, the Dumanils made annual contributions to the graduate program. We opened a master's program in art history in 1982-83, and Mrs. Dumanil immediately wanted to support that, and that support continued up until mid-90s or so. And there were other smaller but nonetheless welcome and significant ways in which they continued to help the university run, even after the Dumanil collection opened. But you'll need to talk to someone else in order to determine when the Institute for the Arts ceased to be part of Rice University.
Yeah. And I'll look. Was there someone who was the director of the Institute or who was...
Essentially, Dominique Dumanil remained the director of it.
Was there anything that you can remember that there was nothing comparable to that at UH, was there?
No, nothing comparable to that.
Do you remember the beginning of the Blackwood at UH?
Yes. I don't know if I remember the beginning, but I do remember that Bill Robinson was brought in 1974 to be the director of the Blackwood,
right.
And he was there for about 10 years. So owing to the Blaffer collection and to their support of that gallery, Blaffer was an active player and significant player on the scene. Bill Robinson was a very active member of the arts community and revived the Houston area exhibitions, which contributed to that sort of surge of feeling in the late 70s that this is a place where something might happen. But there was nothing at the University of Houston that would that was really comparable to everything that's going on in the Institute of the Arts. And I might also say that because of the great impact of the Institute for the Arts at Rice and the prominence of Mrs. Dimmesdale's presence, there was a notion that sort of everything in the arts was funded, supported by the Manils. But I should make clear that the Sewell Gallery, what was then called the Sewell Gallery, now it's the Rice University Art Gallery, but the Sewell Gallery was not part of the Institute for the Arts. It was totally independent of the Domenil operation at the Institute for the Arts, supported by the university and the directors that we hired. We were, first of all, the Sewell Gallery had just been sort of done out of the back pocket of somebody in the art department. John O'Neill made time to do some exhibitions. Chuck Botter, Ross Poulos would maybe be given the relief of one course so that they could do some exhibitions. And it was essentially a Kunsthalle, a little exhibition hall. But it got to a point by about 1980 where that really wasn't working, and we got the university to step up and give us a budget to hire a professional director. Mm-hmm. And Esther DeVecchi, you ask about Esther, and Esther was first here. She was the first professional director here and was here for several years before going on to Blaffer. Well, and she's gone on to school also, but she worked at the Blaffer Gallery for a while and took her.
She were there when Bill was there?
She was hired by Bill towards the very end of his tenure there, and then later became the director, acting director for a short time. Then she went on to school.
That's right. How do you see, just from your perspective, the change in the Blaffer out there? It seems to me it still has continued to be very current. It's hard to be current.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they've gone through a couple of different personalities and directors out there, too.
Yes.
And I'll find out, but I'm not clear how much involvement Blaffer still have. I guess the foundation's founding, I mean, it's funding part of that, but I don't think it's the same, they have the same involvement they have.
That's my understanding too, Sally, but you'll need to ask other people because I'm really not privy to much information about that. I think the Blaffer Gallery is still a vital contributor to things going on in the city. With Marty Mayo's tenure and now Lachi Galuppi, it continues to be a lively place. But exactly what the relationship is to the Blaffer Foundation, if any, at this point, and how it's structured within the university, I don't know. I think that the Blaffer Gallery, though, is independent of the art department over there, and at this point, I think, does not have any tie particularly with the Blaffer Foundation. But you'll have to check that
out. I'll find out. But I think it is independent. They have their own board of directors. They have their own fundraising arm separate from the monies that are raised to help the art department and all of that. Let me see.
We're actually making similar arguments for the Rice University Art Gallery here. I think it's sort of a natural maturing stage of most galleries at universities that they usually began as a facet or an adjunct to the art department and usually are controlled by the artist or the art historians until such a point where the gallery, whether or not it's collecting gallery or a museum or not, becomes sufficiently developed and professional in its own right that it becomes an entity of its own. I've seen that happen where I've gone to school, Princeton University, for example, and it's typical throughout the country.
I think the Williams Gallery stands
on itself. Yes, Williams Gallery does too, as I understand it.
That's fabulous.
Fabulous gallery.
Well, let me stop a minute.
We're just kind of skipping around right now, doing a little reflection and remembering Jerry McCaughey and her impact and her personality. Bill, you might just repeat what you just said
about her charisma. So.
I'm trying to comment on what was most memorable or most important about Jermaine McCaughey. And of course, I knew her only a short time. I first mentioned her genius for conceiving and executing exhibitions, but then I moved back and said, no, that's more of a vehicle. I think what was most essential about Jerry was her ability, her charisma, and her ability to excite people about the arts. All kinds of people, old people, young students, male, female, made no difference, to really excite people about the arts. And her genius for, again, for conceiving and executing exhibitions was perhaps the most important way she did that. But she was a teacher and Pied Piper in all kinds of ways.
Uh-huh.
But more concerned with the exhibits, and that's why I became involved. She's looking for someone to do the art history that that was not her cup of tea, and she did it, and she excited people, but she really was not an art historian, and she wanted some help there. So that's how I came to be in the picture. I was more art historian, but interested in exhibitions, and it looked like we could work together.
Do you have any sense or feeling to be able to take the reflections of those years and move out of this century into the next century? Do you have anything that comes to your mind of a direction that you think Houston is going in the visual arts?
That's a difficult question. I'm a historian. I think I find it easier to look back than to project forward. But it seems to me that Houston is just on a continuing upward arc in terms of what it offers in the arts. And this includes the museums, it includes the educational institutions, it includes the symphony, the opera, the ballet, the theater. It includes patronage in the city. It includes the artists and the alternate spaces. Houston is just getting richer and richer and more sophisticated. I feel very good about the health of the scene. There are other things that I don't understand and can't predict. We were just talking about Jerry McCaughey. It seems much more difficult now for someone to be sort of a Renaissance woman as she was. I mean, she was not exactly a one-woman band in town, but she did so much and did it so well. It would be very difficult for somebody to do that now. There's just so much more going on. There's so many more contributors to it. Things are so much more complicated, so much more costly. It would be nice to have some sort of charismatic or leader or leaders. I suppose we still have them. It's difficult to have one who stood out, something like her. Patronage is changing, where the grand families, the members of those have passed on or are quite aged. In many instances, their children have caught the bug and caught the commitment to the city. I think that's really admirable. The children, for example, the Brown family, are still very active. Some of the Dominil children, etc. It's something special about Houston. But they not always have the great wealth of the parents, so that the patronage and the support is changing from these families who've constantly contributed to the symphony or the opera or to the museums or to the educational institutions, and just a lot more people with perhaps not such deep pockets or still more complex interests coming into play. And government and corporate support is much more prominent now than it was before, much more important. That one thing that seemed like to me that Houston still lacks and has throughout my years here has been some sort of forum for the arts speaking,
for all
of the arts, but particularly I'm thinking of the visual arts. We don't really seem to have ever been able to establish a watering hole, or a publication that is really, you know, seriously discussing the issues and bringing people together and getting them agitated or excited. There's a constantly carping and complaining about that and longing for that. There are some efforts going on now to do something about sort of the critical writing in the city and some sort of gathering place, but whether or not they'll come to pass, I don't know.
I think we need a physical place where people can come together once a month or something, once a week.
I think a physical place is good, and often that's something just sort of happens, you know, a cafe scene or whatever it may be. Of course, that can be stimulated to some extent by a program at a place that, and then one would gather at your bar, cafe, or preference later. But it is good to have a place together, and it'd be wonderful to have some sort of critical publication in the city or the region. Where
there's been fits and starts. With that.
Fits and starts.
Do you think it's a market problem? Market driven? People won't buy.
I suppose that's part of it, but more than that, it seems to be that just no one has emerged who really has the charisma and the drive and the stick-to-it-ness to do that, or who is sharp enough and experienced enough to bridge everything that needs to be bridged to do it. I suppose that's going to happen one of these days. I was just on a program at Diverse Works last month in which a lot of the lamentation about this rose again. It's still there. So, no sort of center, no sense of center or centers that sort of bring us together as community that offer a voice to the city or to government, so that still some silly things are constantly believed and written and said about the arts.
Phil, we were just reflecting about the importance of the core program to Glacel, and then that led into the Artist Collective and the transition and within the black community and the black artist and the younger black artist stepping out and creating the Artist Collective and a transition from the social realism of the 30s, 40s, and 50s and really jumping into the 70s into some of the works we're seeing today. Would you remember the arts vis-a-vis that the involvement of women and the involvement of the blacks and the Hispanics and the Asians in the community?
Yes, Sally and I were just talking a bit about those changes, and I was observing that when I got here in the 60s that the art scene, visual art scene, by and large, was reflective of the nation at large. It was a white man's world, few exceptions. Dorothy Hood was one of the few women around who had a presence on the art scene. And John Biggers and his colleagues at Texas Southern University. But gradually that began to change, but I don't think it changed. Women became, and so-called minorities, artists of color, different national origin, began to emerge and become more important in the 70s. But it really developed in the 80s and continues in the 90s, where now the art scene here reflects more the national scene, that it's multicultural and not a white man's world at all. They're still there, still very important. But very prominent women, lots of them on the scene. African-American, Hispanic-American, Asian-American artists. One thinks of Mel Chen, the young artist coming, often starting at Michelle Barnes Community Artist Collective. Michelle struggles to keep that going, but bless her, she's done it. And, and people like David McGee and Tierney Malone, and recently I saw works by, I think his name is Lehman, who's now teaching at Texas Southern. Some really powerful work by a young artist that represent a radical break with the socialist realism that had dominated Texas Southern to the art black community here for a long time. That has to be a interesting history in itself, so that the arts are much more diverse here in terms of who's producing it, really producing interesting art.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big change that began to emerge in the 70s, but really took off in the 80s and 90s, and again is very representative of the culture at large in this country.
Yeah, changing the demographics, but also the social, the relaxing of so many of the social, not taboos, but restrictions that,
yeah,
that we grew up with.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think the Glass Hill School added a lot too, not so much in this respect, but just enriching the art scene. A lot of good young artists came into the city on this program, and many of them have stayed on, and it's enriched the program a lot.
Let's see, what else?
See, I had a couple of other things I might mention that enriched the whole fabric. One would be the creative writing program at the University of Houston. Now, we're not talking about visual arts, but there are links there. There are links, and that is something that really took root and has made a difference in this community. And former student at the University of St. Thomas, Carl Killians, had a lot to do with that. His bookstore, that's another thing that Houston lacks are books. We have a few good bookstores, some big ones, but it's been difficult for the writers and book collectors in this city. But all of that's part of the richness of the fabric. Thank goodness we've got a Dietering bookstore and a Carl Killians, as well as some of the other big chains that serve us well. But Carl and Herman Dietering contributed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Also, another thing I'm just thinking, didn't mention, began to come out in the 70s, but particularly in the 80s, was a discovery, a rediscovery of what might be called folk art in this city, where the Orange Show, McKissick's Orange Show, opened up, I think, in 1980, and it had been around before that. Only a handful of people knew Jeff McKissick, knew what was going on. And then the Beer Can House and the Fan Man. And this also is something that deals with a cultural phenomenon at large, where in the 70s, people began to look somewhere outside of New York and outside of sort of mainstream isms or movements, and wherever it may be, and beginning to look at folk art and regional art. And Houston found that we had, unbeknownst to us, these wonderful creators, Jeff McKissick, Beer Can House and Fan Man, all of that around here. And that took off in the 80s as well. Still goes on.
Right.
What else? We're forgetting.
Oh, no. I've forgotten about that part.
Yeah. Art Corporate. That's something we're just...
Of course, that will come in under, what is that, Lawndale or Midhouse? The Orange Show started the Art
Corporate. It's Orange Show now.
Yeah, Orange Show started Art Corporate.
There are also in the 70s these international arts festivals downtown that have become something of a disappointment. They're really more entertainment. They have more to do with music.
Well,
but at least in terms of visual arts, the sculptural part of it initially was daring and pretty good. But that's something that's become sort of popular entertainment that has little to do with the arts at this point, unless you accept music or little... ethnic dance and groups and things of the sort, which is not to belittle that, but it is really more of a festival and not arts.
Right. The Main Street Festival, Rudy started over in Herman Park, graduated with the Houston Festival, which graduated with Houston International Festival, and they have never made a real commitment in funding for really fine art or the visual aspect of it, and it's become over the years more and more of a real festival, food place, performance stages.
Food and performance,
right. And people selling their wares in various little tented areas. And there was that brief period for a few years for the festival. You're right, they did the
sculpture along the bayou.
But that has, I think, passed by towards the international country.
And I really enjoy the festival. It just no longer has much to do with the arts. Another facet that you'll have to explore, and I don't know much about, would be the role of the city in the arts. The Municipal Arts Commission,
yeah.
Cash, And I've never been deeply involved in that. There are other people that can do that.